Today we'll try to look at a different angle or go a step a little further on trying to understand the culture. Then if we're accepting as our premise that culture means following the Vedic rules and regulations with a desire to please the Lord, and these rules and regulations come to us then in the form of this varnashram culture, this dharma, then things become a little bit more easy to categorize. You have something in which to work, a framework within which to work. Now then the difficulty comes in, we have these varnas, we have these ashrams, and then we're trying to establish ourselves within these. Right? The ashram side is not so difficult. Generally it's quite easy. We're either married or not married, or, you know, and if we're not married, we're either wanting to get married or not wanting to get married, or we've been married and now we're, you know, through with being married. So it kind of comes quite easily. And then if you're through with being married, then you're still either with the wife, or, you know, you spend time not so much together, or once taken sannyas, or, you know, gone to Vrindavan, is just living as a recluse. So that comes a little bit more obvious. But then when we're dealing with the varnas, that's generally where all the problem comes. Because somehow or another, the nature is anywhere in the material world, especially the Western culture, we find in the modern situation, there's so much emphasis on, you know, position, control, you know, and the prestige that goes along with that. So when looking at this, we won't necessarily look at our own nature and how to engage it, but we will look at what is best for us, you know, what is the most prestigious, you know, and how, what is the platform we can get to acquire for ourselves the best result, you know, the best whatever we're wanting. But the Varnashram system is not actually meant for that. It's actually meant to just take care of our needs, what we want, in a way that we can relate to. So the idea is everybody is doing some activity. Everyone will be maintained by that activity. And that activity is in accordance with your nature. Like a Brahmin just can't get into making business and, you know, doing a big administrative thing and taking their taxes or different things for them, and they don't want to just go out and work for someone at their whims because they have their study, their teaching, their other things to do. So they just take either by begging or just what people give in charity to them. And whatever comes, that's what they set their life at. It means they see what their money is and establish their life. You know, if it's very minimal, then they live very simply. If there's more, they may live more comfortably. If it's more than that, then they start giving it away. So it's a matter of how you maintain yourself. So it's not so much prestige. As Jayadwaita Maharaj was pointing yesterday, is if you have a culture, you have to have a hierarchy. If there's no hierarchy, you cannot have organization. You can't have discipline. There must be. So we see we may say, oh, it's, you know, all equal and all this hierarchy and it's, you know, artificial and this and that. But if we look at the spiritual world, there's a really strong hierarchy there. And that doesn't move. There's no change in it. Absolutely no change. Because it's absolute truth, so there's absolutely no change. So you have Krishna on the top of the pile, like that. And then you have all the heads of the different rasas right under that. And then you have under them their main people. And then you have whatever, your acharyas in that line. And then at the end of that, you have us. So it's fixed. I mean, the basic principle, is das, anu, das, anu, das. The reality is what Krishnadas Kaviraj says, is das, anu, das, 1,000 times removed, servant, like that. And that's fixed. It's there. But in the spiritual realm, everyone is pleased because of that. Because the interesting thing in the spiritual realm, the higher you are up on the pile, the less you taste. The farther down you are, the more you taste. Because you're performing your activity to please the person above you. So you become pleased when they're pleased. So now if you are pleased when the person above you is pleased, then that's one level. But now if there's a person above that that's pleased, then you get to see both of them pleased. That increases your pleasure more. If there's three above, then you get to see three people pleased, you get more pleasure than just seeing one. So like that, how far removed you are, that much you see. And that you get more pleasure. So there, the proximity isn't the important thing. Vaikuntha, they're worried about that. I want to be on the same planet as the Lord, or I want to be in the same, I want to be an intimate associate of the Lord. But in Vrindavan, that worry is not there. Because it's when you're back farther, you see more. You see how they're all pleased, that makes you happy. So the happiness comes from seeing others happy, rather than there's one's own happiness. So, yeah. So the hierarchy is a natural thing. And if we can adjust our mentality, we can also get the benefits of that happiness that is there in working within. In other words, it's a teamwork. So when there's a teamwork, then there is happiness. So the teamwork doesn't have to be equals. There's also, it can be those who are above us, those who are below us, and because everyone is working very nicely to please Krishna, it becomes very strong. That. So there is a taste there, there is a happiness there. And, you know, at least we should theoretically accept it. And then there can be discipline. If we don't accept it, then there's problem. As Maharaj pointed out, there'll be chaos within a few minutes, if not less. So, so that is not a consideration for us, is what our position, just what part we play, and then we have our taste from it. So that is the basic principle, is that wherever we naturally fit due to our conditioned nature, means we have a conditioned nature. If we're intelligent, we understand, I have a body, and that body has its limitations. Right? If I'm very strong, I can do big physical work. I will not be comfortable sitting around all day. If I'm not physically strong, I would rather do something that's not, I would not like to move, you know, bricks all day. I want to do something a little bit more passive. Same with the mind. We have a particular kind of mind. It likes to work in a particular field. And we have a particular kind of intelligence. And that works in, you know, theoretical or practical or in the arts or so many different things. So depending upon what it is, we're comfortable. So it's only natural that an intelligent person establish oneself according to one's physical and psychological nature and is satisfied with that. Right? It doesn't matter the prestige in that. You're satisfied with what you're satisfied. Just like, let's say, we say, okay, mango is the king of fruits, but we don't really like mangoes. Right? We like apples. So now, will we be more satisfied eating apples and letting someone else eat the mangoes? Or do we eat the mangoes because we know they're the king of fruit, so if I'm eating them, then I'm special? Right? You know? What is the reality? We're going to be satisfied eating what we like to eat. Even if it's more prestigious. Otherwise it'll just be a false, you know, prestige. Something we get from the prestige, but it won't address us. Maybe we'll do it for a short time. But when nobody's around and the doors are locked, I'll eat my apples. You know? So that was what Krishna was telling Arjuna. You'll walk away from the battlefield, you'll be very detached, you know, very compassionate, very humble, and you'll go to the forest, and then in the forest you'll get into a fight, and then you'll fight because you're a Kshatriya. You know? You will do these things. You will not avoid them. You know, maybe this moment, because you don't like the downside of the Kshatriya duties. You only like the upside, you know? Like, I have my kingdom and I have all my friends, right? But his duty is to fight, so that means I get the kingdom or the friends, right? I don't get both. But because I won't get both, then, okay, you know, forget it. You know, we go to the forest. But he said you'll still act according to your nature, because you're not actually, it's not your nature at this point to be detached. Maybe later in life you've given up these things, then it may be. But now, no. So one has to accept that one's nature is natural for him. Right? I think nature and natural kind of have probably have a similar root. You know? Like that. They have something to do with each other. So that is the basic principle. Then we take it another step. Now, we're not following the Varnashram just to follow Dharma. The Bhagavatam in the second verse has already said, following the religious principles for material profit is thrown out here. Right? Following religious principles to please Krishna, that is what's being explained. So now, if we look at that point, then we come up with something very, very interesting. Is that this principle that Prabhupada talks about is the Brahman. The Brahman, he first becomes, the first stage of a Brahman is dvija. That one gets the adhikar, or the right, to perform and learn brahminical activities. Right? But when you get that right, you don't know anything. Right? Just like the day someone gets brahminical initiation, they don't know how to do puja, how to do any of these things. But now you have the right to do. Right? Then the next stage is he studies, he learns, he knows things, and he can apply it. And when he knows and he can apply those things expertly, he's called Vipra. Right? Then one is very, respected as a Brahmin, in the society. Then, when performing those activities, by good association, we come in contact with the pure devotees, the Bhagavats. Then we come to the platform where we understand that we're servants of Krishna. And all these knowledge that I have, all the activities I'm doing, that's the brahminical sphere of activity, is all for Krishna. So whatever I'm doing, I do it for Krishna. And then, that is a devotee. And we know then that anyone who's a devotee, then is automatically a Brahmin. Now, what we're looking at here is we're automatically a Brahmin. Why is the Brahmin now a devotee? Because he realized what his work was for is for Krishna. Not that he's doing astrology and then now he's doing it for Krishna. That makes him a devotee. Because he's an astrologer, but astrologer for Krishna, that is a devotee. Right? Or he's a Sanskritist because he's Sanskritist for Krishna, therefore he's a devotee. Or he's into logic and that he's doing it for Krishna, therefore he's a devotee. No, that he understands whatever work he's doing, that is being done for the Lord. So that means anyone who understands that whatever their work is, that is to be done for the Lord, they have that topmost brahminical understanding. Therefore, one can plow the field, but that this is Krishna's field and I'm doing it for Krishna. One is actually a Brahmin by realization, by understanding. This is where the difficult part comes in understanding the devotee, the Vaishnav, Gaudiya Vaishnav view or angle on the Daiva Varnashram system. This is the point, because you can have the brahminical mentality, right, that I do my work for Krishna. We have the brahminical motive to please Krishna. One attempts to be free from desire and free from ego. But one still has one's physical and mental conditional nature. So that means one can have the culture of the Brahman in mentality and work ethic, but have a totally different, non-brahminical, occupational duty. This is where one becomes, it starts to go out of perspective. Because we know everyone's a Brahmin, but at the same time, we have all these natures and all this, and everything gets mixed up. So that means, as far as the culture goes, because we see the Brahmins have their culture, Kshatriyas have theirs. Right? The Brahmins, they live simply. There's so many rules they follow. Right? The Kshatriyas have another set of rules. Basically the same principles. Principles are always the same. Slightly different culture. Right? Kshatriya may keep, hundreds, thousands of wives. He has a whole big thing, this and that. Brahmin doesn't. Right? Vaishyas have another nature. They don't necessarily worry about getting up so early and doing this. They have to do whatever's necessary more for the business. Shudra has to adjust his life for his work. But for the Brahmin, his lifestyle and his work, his life, his adjusts the life, the work for the lifestyle. right? Or makes at least minimal adjustments, you know. Okay, I don't chant my rounds now, I chant them later in the day because I dress the deities or this or that. So it's just a matter of the priorities that is there. So one can, so what we see is that those who are Gaudiya Vaishnavas, specifically anyone who's Vaishnav, Sampradayak, then they follow the Brahminical culture. See, this is important. When you have devotees means anyone who accepts the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the Daiva Varnashram is very broad. And you'll have two classes of devotees following Daiva Varnashram. One is the ordinary devotees, those who accept the supremacy of the Lord, but they themselves don't necessarily follow the principles very strictly. You know, they know the philosophy, but don't follow very nicely, or they don't know the philosophy very well, or they're born in the family of devotees, of, you know, properly situated devotees, but they themselves don't, you know, take much care in it. If you ask them, you know, are you a devotee? And they'll say yes. But, you know, they may wear tilak, may not wear tilak, may wear proper dress, not follow a nice program, may chant, may not, like that. In other words, this is ordinary devotee. So anyone who's accepted the Supreme Lord is an ordinary devotee. Then you have, from those, you have the sampradayak devotees. It means those who have made the endeavor to surrender to a bona fide spiritual master and to follow the rules and regulations that come along with that surrender, responsibility. So now, what we're talking about, we're not talking about the Daiva Varnashram as followed by the ordinary devotees. Right? Because the plan will be very similar to, you know, how the Asuric Varnashram will work. Because you have your varna, you have your ashram, you are that, you identify with that, you do those things. But you know it's pious and proper and all these things. There may be an understanding to do it for God, there may not be. But you understand this is God's plan, I follow God's plan. I'm pious, I follow God's rules. But the sampradayak devotees, they're following a Daiva Varnashram, means that what I'm doing for the Lord. I have a conditioned nature, I must engage in the Lord's service. So therefore, I engage in this way. I do those prescribed duties, but for Krishna. It's a definite determination. Like that. We have that desire. So this means they get situated in a different culture. They don't follow these four different cultures, they follow the one culture, the Brahminical culture. And the Brahminical culture is actually very simple, culture in the way of how they live. The Brahminical culture will be based on either the Vedic terms of sadhana, the pancharatric terms of sadhana, as given by the acharyas. So the Brahminical standard, as far as we go, we follow pancharatra. Then this means basically we're waking up in the morning, we're chanting the Lord's name, we're remembering the Lord, we offer our obeisances as the spiritual master, then we take our, we brush our teeth, use the toilet, take our bath, then we put our tilak, we wear neck beads, we wear Brahmin threads, we wear devotional clothing, we chant our Gayatri, we go to the temple, we ring the bell, we offer our obeisances, we see the Mangal Artik, we may clean the temple. And in our activities in the temple and with the devotees, we take care of guests, we respect and interact with devotees, we hear the scriptures, we chant the holy name, we take prasadam, we worship Tulsi, and we do some service for the temple or the dham. That is the Brahminical scope in which they act. And if you'll notice, that's exactly what Prabhupada has given everybody in ISKCON to do. It's such a nicely framed that devotees don't really think that they have just followed all the rules of Pancharatra. What I've just described now is anything that is required of any Brahmin within the Pancharatra. It doesn't matter what Sampradaya, this, that. This is what they do. There may be some finer details, you know, how they take a bath, this. But the principles of the areas that they work in, that's it. There aren't more areas. And we see every devotee does that. And this is our like sphere in which we act. And that is the Brahminical culture. You know, we're not living like Yudhishthira. You hear on the battlefield how he wakes up. You know, So, you know, when it's time for him to wake up, then the singers start singing, the dancers start dancing, you know, the reciters of mantras start reciting mantras, they start playing drums and bugles and horns and veenas and everything like that, and they make so much noise that it's heard up to the heavenly planets, like that. And that's how he wakes up. So does that sound familiar? You know any devotees doing that? Okay, so we won't bother getting to the rest. You know, it said when one of the points of logic means logic and argument. Logic means, you know, it means the human being's form of discussion, like that. So when you defeated the big wrestler, all the small ones are considered defeated. Right? You don't go into guerrilla warfare. You just like that. So since, you know, we've defeated this point, we will not even bother with the rest at this point. So we can see we're following the Brahminical culture. Right? Even if someone's living outside, is not necessarily so strict, they still do these things. Maybe they do them more nicely, maybe less nicely. But this is the field in which they deal. So that means all devotees are following the Brahminical culture. And that is the interaction. So when we're dealing in the temple and dealing in these activities, then generally everyone's accepted on this Brahminical platform. That is the thing. Of course, we have to endeavor to not perform activities improperly, to avoid offenses and all that. But that's the platform. And we do our morning program, we have some kind of evening program or study in that, and that is our lifestyle. Then in between the morning and evening, we have something that we do particularly for Krishna. Right? We do things in the temple, we do things outside the temple. You know, it's either under the direction of the temple authorities or we're working on our own. But whatever it is, then that is, we are not that. That's what Prabhupada said, it's an offense to consider that a devotee is of one of those varnas, that they are a Brahmin, a Kshatriya. No. They're a devotee who's doing that occupational duty. That is the point. That is what's necessary for them at this point. That's their conditioning. That's what they're good at. And then they follow that. And it becomes very, very easy. Yeah. So this is, if that understanding is there, that we have follow the Brahminical culture, we have the, or at least endeavor for the understanding and mentality and consciousness of a Brahmin, then in that we situate ourselves because of our conditional nature in one of four ashrams and one of four varnas. Like that. Then it becomes very easy to understand the system. Then there's not a whole fight over, well, who's got the power and who's got the money. Because generally, just my experience when we discuss social development, then we limit ourselves basically to one ashram and two varnas. Right? It means the main problem is nobody's really caring who the Brahmins are, because who listens to them anyway? You know? And the Shudras, you know, what do you worry about? You know, Brahmacharis are, you know, they're, what do you call it? They're not seriously considered because they're not honest anyway. And, you know, sannyasis are, you know, whatever, they've got their own trip. And vanaprastas, who's ever heard of them? So therefore, you know, Kshatriya's got the power and the Vaishya's got the money, and, you know, they'll only give money if they also have power. And, you know, the Kshatriyas only get the money if they also relinquish some of the power. And then, you know, we can enjoy all that facility in the Grihastha Ashram. So this is the basically Western approach to Varnashram Dharma. Right? Right? But unfortunately, this doesn't fully address the nature of all the living entities. You know, we still have another, five varnas and ashrams to consider. So the varnashram system means you take the whole picture. When you understand the whole picture, then you can understand where you fit into that picture. So now there has to be two levels of understanding of the whole picture. One is we have enough to understand how we fit in and do our needs and our business. The second is if we can understand deeply how it operates, then we can help others situate themselves, or we can organize the system so that we see that there is place for everyone to be situated. like that. So you have two levels of understanding of this. That. But everybody must have some understanding of it, like that, enough to situate yourself. That those who can have more, they have more, then they can either advise or they can organize so that the system runs. Like that. Then, now let us, a connected topic, then we can get into some questions. I'm just wondering if I should make this next point, then go into questions, because it's so related, it may answer a few things. Now we look at how does this fit in. Means within our devotional service. Okay, now we know some service, but then our sadhana. How does the sadhana, the culture, and our service also match? Because we're following brahminical sadhana. And the devotional sadhana, but we have our service. So we go back to the point Krishna makes in the Gita of the different levels of ideal of surrender. First is best is just complete 100%, surrender on the spot, which is possible. The Bhagavatam gives a few examples of some devotees who've done that. Right? The gopis did like that. Then we see, the wives of the Brahmins, Yajnik Brahmins, they did like that. When Krishna went to Mathura and Dwarka, so many people did like that. But it was more rare. It was not the general rule. So if one can do that, that is the best. Like Maharaj Katvanga, in a moment, just surrender. That's the best. You don't waste any time. It's very direct, very simple. Right? There's no difficulties. You just do it. But if you can't do that, if that's difficult, means that there's some obstacles, then you follow sadhana bhakti. So now, when we get into sadhana, then we're dealing now, we've come from the first platform means we are not on the conditional platform. Right? We're actually on the Brahma-Bhuta platform, though we're moving in the world. Then you come in contact with the pure devotees, then that is immediately fully awakened, and one takes it up. That's the first platform, just fully surrendering. If one can't do that, that means because the conditional nature still has to be attended to. Conditional nature means our gross and subtle conditioned nature, the body and the mind, intelligence, and ego. That has to be addressed. It means we're attached to it, we must deal with it. So we must engage it in Krishna's service. So the first platform of that, or the subtlest, is just the platform of sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti means you just perform those activities that I mentioned. What I mentioned is the brahminical culture, the foundation of that. You just do those things. You don't do anything else. So all you do basically is temple activities, temple service. And that's all. And it doesn't really matter so much what one does, but one does these things. One's fully absorbed in chanting and all these other things. And that's it. Chanting, preaching, taking prasadam. And we saw that the interaction of devotees is there, so we're respecting those above us. We're friends with those who are equal. We're compassionate to those who are below that. So we see that, and we're taking prasad, that we woke up, then there's also we go to sleep. And the end of it is we go to sleep remembering the Lord, like that. So the we see that all our physical and all our emotional needs are taken care of, but in a very, very sattvic platform. Totally just mode of goodness platform. And all those things are directly in connection with Krishna. They're services that are directly connected to Krishna, or directly connected to those things, are like chanting. You have two categories. What's called mukya means those activities that they themselves can deliver you, like chanting Hare Krishna, hearing Bhagavatam, or those things are supporting that. They're called gona, like taking our bath, putting on our tilak, all these different things. So between these two, they're very directly or just under that engaged in. They're not even neutral, they're positive, engaged in service. So if one can be satisfied with that, then that is good. Because it deals with our spiritual nature, our emotional, and our physical nature. Everything is complete in itself. It's a complete system. But you still don't give up the desire to fully surrender to Krishna. So the higher platform, the first platform is kept, but we work on the second with that goal. Krishna says, if that also is not possible, then he says, then you work for me. That means now the conditional nature is a little stronger. We can't just do any service, can't chant all day and just do some preaching when it comes up and take prasad when it's there and just do the needful on that platform of goodness. The conditional nature needs a little more attention. You know, there's a little more passion, a little more ignorance, like that, a little more attachment. Then we have to identify what is our nature, our conditioned nature, and then do that for Krishna. Right? Work for Krishna. So then the Varnashram system comes in there. Otherwise, Varnashram system is there in the platform of sadhana, but only the Brahman's aspect of it. So Brahmins, the four ashrams are there, and the one activity and the occupational duties of the Brahmins, and that's it. But that's your full-time engagement. So five of the varnas and ashrams are manifest. Okay? If you can't, then Krishna says, then work for me. Then you have to add in the other three varnas. Okay? Ashrams are established. We see that. Yeah. Then one is able to know, okay, I can do this kind of service for Krishna. I may be able to do temporarily another service if there's an emergency. But as a long-term thing, I'm not satisfied unless I'm doing my particular nature. So now when doing that, we still perform our sadhana with the goal of fully surrendering to Krishna. And then these are like the best of them. And this is basically as far as at least someone who's definitely very close with the temple. You know, dependent upon the temple, or very much part of the whole temple activities. But if that still is a difficulty, because here you're working for Krishna, means what you're doing, and it's for Krishna, fully for Krishna. If not, then Krishna gives a fourth. Then at least give the result. Right? You're not working for Krishna, means ultimately you're working for Krishna. It's my work, my results, you know, my money, but I give to Krishna. That's the fourth level. So that kind of person must situate themselves outside the sphere of the temple dependence. It means you can't be in that mentality and expect the temple is going to maintain you. Unless the temple wants to, like, take you on for a specific job or like that, they need it, so then there may be an opportunity for that. But one cannot expect that. That one must be honest, like the brahmacharis, and be out of the temple and do your own work, maintain yourself, get your own money, facilities, and if it goes nice, great. If it doesn't go nice, that's the way it is. We cannot blame anyone else, because it's your work, not Krishna's. Though you do it for Krishna, ultimately. Do we understand? It's a subtle difference. That's the point. All these things are so subtle, one can be in one or in the other. So one has to be very, very careful. Like I've seen in Bombay, both these kind of you know, devotees, a life member, you know, businessmen and that. There's those that are outside, they do their business, they may be initiated and all this, and now and again they come to the temple fairly regularly, but they'll come at a festival, do something, give some regular donations and all that. But they do their own thing and all that. And it's kind of like they come to Krishna or come to the temple on their terms. Like that. No obligations. No one expects, and they don't, like that. Then you have another kind who, they are part of the whole temple scene. They have their business, they're making plenty of money and this and that, but they consider, we are temple devotees. I live outside, I have my whole thing, I maintain myself, I don't burden the temple. And they take part in temple activities, organizing the festivals, managing, whatever needs to be done, they do it in their areas of expertise. And their money is for Krishna. But because they know money, they know how to manage money, they manage it also for Krishna, because others may not know how to manage it. Because money is their area, they know what to do with it. You know, so in discussion with others, and others in the community, and other like-minded persons like them, and the temple authorities, they decide, okay, we're going to do a Rath Yatra, this or that, and, you know, each person's going to give so much money, and this one's going to manage this one's that, and it works very nicely. So you don't see any difference between them and the full-time devotees. Except the ones that are full-time, meaning those who are living in the temple. because they're full-time devotees also. The only difference is they have more facilities, more stuff, and the temple devotees has less. Right? So we see the temple devotees are very nicely established on that the platform of sadhana or those activities engaging in nature, but it's fully Krishna's things. And they're outside doing it. So in those who are inside the temple, you only have sadhana and working for Krishna. And outside the temple, you can have working for Krishna and those who you give the results to Krishna. So it makes it very, very easy to understand. Is that this sadhana and that is just a matter of development. And with time, it's understood by following properly, you'll move to the next and next levels. That's what whole idea is. Grihastha life may be performed on either of those, working for Krishna or giving the result to Krishna. But vanaprastha means sadhana. You've come up to that platform. Or at least you're working for Krishna. Like that. It can't be the lower platform. Otherwise, it's not vanaprastha. Right? And the sannyasa then must mean just the sadhana. So like that, then it becomes very easy to understand where one's situated. And the whole idea is another thing we'll bring in, is the aspect of pravritti nivritti. So pravritti means we're engaging ourselves in following the rules and regulations of the Lord. Not specifically sadhana, but varnashram. And within this, you find that there is a aspect nivritti, means because there's so few rules to follow, because you have so few stuff. So brahmacharis, vanaprastha, sannyas, that is nivritti. Because you're dealing less with the senses. Of course, everybody's dealing with senses. Everybody has some possessions. But because the amount of rules and the amount of attachments and amount of things are less, therefore, three are called nivritti and one is called pravritti. But the purpose of both is to get to Krishna. Engage whatever your attachments are in Krishna's service. Right? One has an attachment of being detached. You engage that in Krishna's service. And one has an attachment of being attached. They engage that in Krishna's service. This is a very simple thing. It is not a problem. We have to accept all these words, terminologies, and the system is a very nice, user-friendly. You know? We have to be very, very careful to take these terminologies and concepts and turn them into buzzwords and issues and all these kind of things. Like that. We have to take them as they are and how they relate to each other. Then we get a very nice package that we can very pleasantly work within. Okay, is there any questions or comments on this? Yes.
Yeah. Nowadays we see in many schools they take into account the attitude of the students. They made a talk with the student and they see some psychologists, they see what is their attitude so that to address them in a proper way. But we see this point is a little lacking in our society to address some person specifically to some varna, some. So what's your advice? What do you think about?
Well, the basic point is, as you'll see, because you're quoting Western systems that they start to do, because those parents and students are submissive to that system. They respect the school. They respect the authorities of that school. So therefore, there is discipline. There is, and the system works. That's why that principle is so strongly enunciated in the Vedic literature. But the devotees, then you have to see is they have to be willing to accept this kind of direction. Right? Of course, you must have those who understand this as the ones who are giving that direction. But we must be willing to accept it. We must be able to give up our, deity of the, the three varna and ashram concept, like that. Instead of eight, We only see three. So we must be able to give that up. And generally, the difficulty comes is, one is at the schools of them being able to recognize it. But even if they were to work in that direction to do that, that others would recognize that. Because these are our difficulties. If you want to establish a brahmachari, that means the brahmachari is not his focus, his center is the school. Right? Or whoever he's working under, like in the temple, then the temple authorities. It's not the home. He transfers from the parental ras of the family to the parental ras of the school. Right? If he doesn't, he just stays in the house, he's a grihastha. Right? He's an unmarried grihastha, he's a bachelor. But he's not a brahmachari. A boy that grows up in the house, never goes to the gurukul, is not a brahmachari. They're just an unmarried grihastha. They're just too young. And when they get older, they'll get married. Like that. That's the Vedic understanding. But you'll find very few parents will let the school actually take care. One may say, okay, schools haven't taken care. But then, what is the solution? Not send the kids to the school? Send them to the karmic school? Or see that qualified people are running schools? This is the point we were making yesterday. Is solutions to problems only come, I mean, solutions to our material difficulties, sensual and, or physical and, you know, how do you say, emotional or metaphysical, only come when you have dharma. They cannot come in any other way. Absolutely will not come. That's like saying, I'll boil water without sticking it on the fire. And I'll just put it in the pot and put it in the closet and, you know, it'll boil because I want it to. I demand it. I start a movement. I have a web page, you know, and this water will boil in the closet. And we don't care about all these other, you know, fundamental, fanatic, right-wing conservatives who say you have to put it on the fire, otherwise it won't boil. We don't care. You know, we have our rights. We have our say. But it's just nature. You can look in history. That's what Western history is good for. You want to see what doesn't work, read it. Right? And then if you're smart, you'll avoid it. And if you want to see what does work, read the Bhagavatam. Right? That is also history, but that works. Like that. So you must accept that if you want to solve the problem of Gurukul, means you have to have qualified teachers in there with qualified students and qualified parents. Right? So the teacher can't be with the student because the parents weren't Krishna conscious when they conceived the child. Right? You cannot blame the school or the temple authorities or, you know, the GBC or ISKCON, that they were not sitting there next to your bed cheering you on when you conceived the child saying, remember Krishna, you know. They were not. They were not there. The parents did that themselves. So what is their consciousness? That's what they got. So now, if you don't get someone with high consciousness, it's not easy to deal with, then you have to have a special school for that. But if the parents know, they dropped out of the heavenly planets. So, you know, Krishna says in the Gita, they're born in a family of devotees. Right? Like that. But there's different grades of devotees. You may have attracted a bloop fringy. Right? I mean, there are devotees that have been right out on the edge and they have died. You know, and, you know, it's natural that they'll come back and like that. And, you know, and this isn't the only time. Lord Chaitanya's movement's been going on for a while, so there may be those dropping, you know, coming back from later. And you catch someone around the edge. Someone doesn't accept authority, doesn't accept the GBC, doesn't like the, you know, management, ISKCON, this kind of things, and administration. Oh, Prabhupada, all this, of course, but whatever, the other side. Now, if that person leaves the body, then where is he going to take up his devotional service again? There's a great pure unalloyed devotee and all that? No, he's going to continue. Krishna says, you go up to 50%, you start the next life at 51. So they still don't accept authority, still don't want to work in a management structure, still can't relate to other devotees, still have material attachments, you know, don't really like to dress like devotees, act like devotees, listen to devotee music or anything like that. So that's the kind of kid, if you're not careful, you can get. They're available, right? On the list of kids available, like that, they're on the list, you know? So if you want, you know, Prahlad Maharaj, then you have to be like Hiranyakashipu. Right? Now, one may laugh, but now we should look at this, which is very interesting, right? You have Diti and Kasyapa, you know, who are, you know, Kasyapa is a son of Brahma, right? So he's a Brahma Rishi. And Diti is very qualified. They have a demon for a son. Then their demon son, like the best of the demons, right? You can't, there's no one more demoniac than Hiranyakashipu. He was like the king. You know? He has a pure devotee as a son. Now we should look at this. This is very essential for this point. Since we're just talking on parents, like that. Then, as we discussed, Diti and Kasyapa. Diti was very interested in position, right? Her sister, Aditi, already had children. She was very anxious that her prestige was not as much. So she was totally interested in prestige, position. So Labh, Puja, Pratishtha, you know, distinction, adoration, profit, that's all in that same category. They're all connected. So whichever angle you come from, the other one is there. So she was very much interested in that, you know, the wealth of the children, the prestige that comes from it, and the respect that will come from that, from the others in the family and all those things. So that was her motive, why she wanted the child. Right? She wasn't interested in sense gratification. She just wanted that. And Kasyapa told her, you wait a few minutes. It's the Sandhya now, I've just finished my yajna and all that, and this is Shiva's time. So as soon as the Sandhya is over, then from that time on, the scriptures say this is proper. Right? In other words, he's professing that they, you know, follow what the Gita recommends, that you plan having children. And then that's dharma. Right? But she was basically saying, you know, no, I want right now. You know, it just means if, you know, we conceive a child now, that means, you know, 24 minutes earlier, I'll get all the prestige and everything I want. You know, so I don't want to wait that 24 minutes. Like that. So then, because he's not so controlled in his senses, like Kardama, therefore he fell prey to this lust. So he was attracted by the senses and by the thought of spending that time comfortably with the wife. Right? So the wife was into Hiranya and the husband was into Kashipu. Right? So in other words, you get exactly what you pay for. You know, you don't get something else like that. So the kid is exactly the combination of consciousness of the parents, not something else. It won't be something else. Now, one may ask, well, okay, now you have this demoniac father, how do you get Prahlad? This is an interesting story. This is told in the Nrisimha Puran. That the first time Hiranyakashipu went out to do his austerities with his brother Hiranyaksha, so they went up to the mountains and started their austerity. And then the demigods became very worried because, you know, already they're such big demons and making so much trouble that they were thinking if he does austerities, he's going to become even more powerful and more trouble. So they're thinking what to do, and none of them can do anything, you know, because already he's been more powerful than them. You know, just they're afraid of him. So then they're all sitting and discussing, and then Narad Muni says, don't worry, I'll take care of it. Right? And then he tells, I think his friend Parvata Muni, I think it was Parvata who went with him. Then they went down to where they were performing the austerities, and they both took the forms of sparrows, little dinky birds. And they flew over to a branch that's, you know, within earshot, you know, quite close to Hiranyakashipu, but not too close. You know, they're not fools. And they sat down on the branch and they, you know, ruffle their feathers a little bit, sit there nicely, and then they start chanting at the top of their voices, Om Namo Narayanaya. Right? And if you've heard sparrows, they have a very annoying, piercing voice. Right? Their chirp is not sweet. It's very piercing. Like that. So you can imagine them chanting as loud as they can, Om Namo Narayanaya, right next to Hiranyakashipu. So Hiranyaka, it breaks his meditation. So then he, you know, breaks the meditation, sees these two birds there, tries to shoo them away. So they just move a little bit up on the branch, you know, situate themselves, start chanting again. Then he gets real angry now, you know, because he's a big controller. He couldn't get rid of two birds. And they're chanting the name of his enemy, you know, his life enemy. So then he reaches over, picks up his bows and arrows and goes to shoot. By the time he shoots, and they fly away. So he tries to go back to his meditation, but now he's so disturbed with this, he can't concentrate. So he figures, okay, we'll, you know, go back to the palace, you know, take a few days, and then we'll come back for our austerities. So he and his brother went back down to the palace. And then at the palace, then he came back and he thought, you know, what a, you know, everyone's, you know, interested to see him back. And he told the story, terrible story of hearing the Lord's holy name being chanted. And then, you know, he set about busying himself in the pleasures of the palace, you know, listening to music, taking good food and drinking and being with friends and, you know, just doing anything to remember, to forget this terrible experience. But unfortunately, he couldn't forget. It still was just like riveted in his mind, Om Namo Narayanaya, and these birds, you know. So then he decided, okay, all this didn't work, so no problem. I'll spend the night intimately with my wife. You know, of course, I'll forget all things with that. So then he spent the time, and then at the moment of conception, he's thinking of these two birds, which is Narad Muni and Parvati Muni, great sages and devotees. And he is constantly in his mind, Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namo Narayanaya, like this. So this is his consciousness at the moment of conception. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj, the pure devotee. Right? So this is the point. That's why Narad Muni later, then when the demigods catch Hiranyakashipu's wife when he went for the second time for austerities, he said, don't worry, you know, this is not a demon, this is a devotee. He just knows, like that. So he instructed Prahlad in the womb, and then like that. So that is there. Then you have, you know, you want a result out of the Bhagavatam, it starts with the parents, you know. Then you must have good teachers. The teachers must understand their duties, have the brahminical qualities, and they must be able to identify the nature of the student and know how to engage that nature in the Lord's service properly. Right? And the student has to be prepared nicely by the parents. See, there's a time, you see in India, generally you find Indian parents, by the time the kid comes to the Gurukul, they've already learned respect for authority, gentleness in dealing with others, they deal very nicely or compassion to those that are younger than them. And they have an interest to learn. Because when they ask questions, someone will always answer it. They'll spend the time with them. So they put a lot of energy into the kid that kid can give a lot of energy out. You know, they can absorb a lot of energy, meaning they can absorb, you know, proper channeled energy from authority, you know, or in a very nice, pleasant way. And they are able to give that out to those below them. So this is what happens in the family before the child gets to Gurukul. Is the members of the family, especially the women, that they have the full time, the full freedom to give that energy to the kids. And the kids become very powerful, very qualified, very cultured. Then when they come to the school, then now, you know, you have something, like you've taken, you know, gold ore and made it into gold. Right? The parents have done that. Now the teacher can make the gold and make it into an ornament. They can refine it. So what happens is they go from the shelter and that relationship with the parents is parental rasa. They go to the teacher now for that shelter and parental rasa. It's the same rasa, but because there's no bodily attachment, therefore the child does not take things for granted. Right? In the house, you just walk in, you get something to eat. You throw your stuff on the floor, your mother will pick it up. You know, everything, it's automatic. It's an amazing place. You walk in the door and everything's automatic. But it's not automatic. People are there, they're endeavoring, things are going on, there's so many things happening. And the reason it's that it seems automatic because everyone there is trained. Father's trained, mother's trained. So therefore, it seems automatic. But now the child won't understand that. It means the subconscious principles they take, but the conscious they don't. So they go to the school Because in the school, then the teachers make them conscious of what are those principles. What is actually, they become conscious of what is authority, what is their position, what is dealing with those equals and juniors and above. What is their questioning goes from, you know, why is the grass green and the sky is blue and these things into inquiring about spiritual topic matters and those activities that you can engage, you know, according to one's varna and ashram in the Lord's service. So they become, that was what was this morning, the point of jigyasu, shreya uttama. That was that meaning, is they become inquisitive in this. So all that is done. Then the teacher can take them very far. So when you have all these in place, good parents, good student, good child, good teacher, then you get the results directly seen in the Bhagavatam. So if something's wrong in it, then rather than throw the system out, you know, Prabhupada gives the example of removing the eye when there's a cataract. No, you remove the cataract. Like that. Is that if there's been problems, it's not that the Gurukul system doesn't work. It's just we don't work. We're a problem. We don't know how to parent the children properly. We don't know how to raise them. Right? The teachers aren't trained to know how to teach, and the kids aren't trained. So therefore there's a mess. No? The Western system isn't a great alternative. We must understand that all the what do you call it? The different institutions and persons who are involved in, you know, school mismanagement, you know, abuse cases and all these things and all that, that they weren't just developed in the recent years just for ISKCON schools. Right? The only place where abuse is going on the planet is there. Right? It's going on outside this. So we ourselves, being part and parcel of the Western environment, we are also influenced by it. So as it degrades, you know, especially we find the glorious American culture like that. I heard a very interesting point today. I think it was English gentleman that made a point that America's culture is very unique in the world because they went from barbarism to degradation without going through the normal intermediate step of civilization. Right, you know? Most others, they're barbarians, they become civilized and they become degraded. Right? But America just, you know, they're so practical, you know, practical minimalists that they just, well, we see our position now as barbarians. We know the goal, the future, becoming degraded. So why waste time? We'll just go straight there. Yes. So we, you know, should not be overly influenced by this phenomena. So we take these things. Only solutions are these Vedic solutions, right? Of course, we have to be practical. How much we can apply, we apply. How much we don't, we do the best we can. It means it takes time to develop. But unless you have a goal, and unless you have a framework or a concept to work with, one won't get anywhere. It's not practical. So the most practical is the Vedic, because it's made for the material world. You know, the manufacturer of the material world made the Vedic culture to run it. Right? So they're both from the same factory. Right? They're both made by God. While the modern things are made by us, by the people. So this is our point. We can either accept that there's absolute truths, right? And we come in line with these truths, or we ourselves dictate what is absolute truth, and then we mold the society and culture for this, right? That is basically what we're faced with. The point of do we keep, you know, the philosophy and religion together, or do we keep the philosophy and make our own religion, and therefore we have to adjust the philosophy. This is the bottom line. So for Western culture, this decision was made, you know, some thousands of years back, at the time of Socrates. Right? Generally, when we think of Western culture, we think back to the Greeks, and we think back to that time. So Socrates was saying, there's an absolute truth, we must come in line with it. He didn't know much about it, but he knew that it existed, and that we must find the absolute truth and mold our life according to it. And the sophists said, no, we make the rules. What we need now, what is the culture now, we adjust with that now, and that becomes our thing. In other words, the voice of the people is the voice of God, right? Vox populi, vox Dei, right? So the whole Western culture is based on this sophist philosophy. And you see, that's what's going on today. Your modern revolutions, your modern disturbances, and everything, it's all based on that. We set the standards. Not God has a standard, we have to come up to it. We set the standards. Because it's practical, right? I like this, so it's practical for me to adjust everything around me so that I can get what I want. Rather than things aren't going right, that's because there may be something wrong with me. I have to adjust so I come in line with the proper standard, then things go right. Understand? So it's just a matter of which side you look at it. So we can either accept the Vedic situation, you know, or we can accept the modern. The sophist situation. And that's basically what we're left with. So we may say practical this and then jump up and down, but it's nothing new. Right? I've heard devotees say that we're a unique breed, we're something special. Like Maharaj was saying yesterday, I'm a victim, now I'm special. I was just a face in the crowd, but now I'm a victim, so I'm special. Right, and we victims get together and make clubs, and then you know all these things. Like you have, I heard you have the herpes club. You know, everyone sits around and cries on each other's shoulder, and you know that we all got herpes, and you know stuff like that. And so, you know, we become special because of this. So that is the whole point. I want to make myself special, rather than I'm just 1/10,000th, the tip of the hair, and there's unlimited numbers of us here, and I'm just one of them. And if I want things to go right, I have to adjust my life to please Krishna. Right? So that is the point. We may say practical this, that, but practical is what actually works. And what actually works is Vedic. If anything works in the Vedic culture, I think Maharaj mentioned that yesterday, it's because it's just a reflection or a little bit left of it. Right? The European, this whole European and Anglo-Saxon culture, just the burnt remnants of the Kshatriyas that ran off to Europe. You go to Middle Asia, you know, carouse around there for a while, and then make some invasions, and then come in. You know, it seems that the first group was more into just getting it together. They went in, all the Celts and all that, and established their culture. And then the ones that were more wild and woolly then roamed around in the mid-Asia, and then, you know, came in a few times and invaded and then took over. So we have this kind of a culture. So we can take that. And so whatever little bits there that work in the culture is because of that ancient connections. Or someone's intelligent enough to look at the material nature, see it works like this, and then make their philosophy. The problem of coming from this way of ascending is that you may learn the points, but you can't connect them to God's points of religion. Right? You figure out function of the material world on the sensual platform, you know, or on the economic platform, but you can't connect it with the Lord's rules of life, you know, dharma, religion. So in other words, it has no culture, you know. It becomes a culture of lack of culture. You know, what was your point for going in and making that observation? That's going to be the basis of that culture. Well, the Vedic thing is how to get out of this material nature is the reason that we have the rules. And then that comes down and then comes to the next levels. How to economically develop, how to enjoy the senses, all in line with so that you can get out of here. So these are the two angles we can come from. Like that. Coming down from the authority of the Vedas, and then apply it according to the time, place, and circumstance the best you can. Or we can remove that and come up from the bottom and be always totally lacking in culture. You can't get beyond that. That's the point. Modern, the speculation cannot come up to that level. By definition, it can't. You know? Yes.
Maharaj, you were speaking about this ISKCON culture, the Visvaipanchayata culture. And according to it, no matter how far now one is, one follows this rabbinical culture, gave the example of the Sada Lama rising up when you follow all of this. When one looks at the ISKCON devotees, and myself also, but it's like a general observation, then the rabbinical devotees, to some extent, they can maintain it. But as soon as you have a varna lower than that, then when they get so much into service, or when they get family, whatever, some of this sadhana seems to go. It happens very often. So then I wonder, is it natural just because we are kind of, we get this rabbinical culture imposed on us even though we are not brahmanas by birth? Or is it because our motivation to join this consciousness proper? Or I don't know, what is the reason? Because it seems so common.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would kind of look at it from another, I'd take a different angle. It's that the devotees have it, there's a tendency, I see this in the children in the school as students. Whatever I can do, huh? Yes. What was the question? The question basically is that when someone comes into the society, then we follow this brahminical culture that I was talking about, where we see that others, when they get into other activities, then that are not necessarily brahminical occupational duties, they have trouble with this sadhana and lifestyle. So two aspects are there. One is sadhana and the principles of it. You know, so maybe for a Brahmin, following the sadhana may be the most easy, just by conditional nature. Even they're not devotional, they can follow it by conditional nature. But the point is this is the culture of someone who is interested in devotional activities. Right? So anyone who has that strong devotional drive, it won't be a difficulty to follow. They may have to adjust a little bit, you know, and do the best they can. But the principles of it will be maintained. That's the point. Is maybe I don't sit down and chant 16 rounds at one shot without moving. Maybe I chant something here, then I'm chanting on the bus, and then I chant at some breaks at the work, and I chant a little bit in the evening, you know, like that. So it's not the ideal, like that. But in other words, it's, you know, or we can't necessarily cook everything and offer everything, so we're outside, we buy a little something, we offer it, and, you know, like that. We don't have deities. But the principles remain.
Just a little devotion, even if we are not drawn.
Yeah, so that always remains. But why, I would say, is the tendency is that it would drop, would be, that's one aspect, is that we have to see the difference between the ideal application of it and the details being manifest nicely, and the application of it, that the principles are never compromised. Okay, so that's one platform. Then another way, another aspect of looking at it will be that devotees aren't understanding that this is our culture, and we don't take this kind of duty, non-attached duty, very seriously. It means, okay, I'm attached to the family, I'm attached to money, I have to get it, you know. So I do that, but because of attachment, not because it's duty. Because then if some problem is there in the home, the husband and wife don't get along, now I don't want to get money, right? And then the thing gets worse, and then there's more plates flying and more things happening, and then it just all breaks up, right? And then we decide, okay, it was that one, you know. I was all right, but the other one didn't work properly. So you get a new one. So we don't value the rules. We don't value that these are our duties, we must do them. Right? And so this is there. I'll work it in somehow. Right? Just like I have to maintain the house, I have to have money. Somehow or another I work it in. Right? Like that. Because it just has to be done. But the point is I only do it as long as there's attachment. So we have to learn to do activities because we're supposed to do them rather than from the platform of attachment. Right? Then a third thing is why also it's easy to drop the rules, not understand this is a body of rules that we always have to follow. I've seen this in students, is that what you do at a younger age, when you get older, you figure that you're more advanced, you won't be doing things you could do the first day you walk in. So it's like I've seen when I mix adult students with the younger children. If the children are able to do it, the adult student thinks, I shouldn't be doing that, I'm wasting my time, I can do something better. Right? So when you come into the temple, you know, you're a new bhakta, new bhakting, they teach you, you know, in the first few months how to, you know, do all these different things and put on your tilak and all that. And now in advance, it's not so important. They don't understand that these are just, the Vedic concept of learning is nothing that you learn is useless. You know, it's like in, I don't know if you have here, but in English you have things like, you know, they call it, you know, these little nursery rhymes and other useless things. You'll never use as an adult, really, in your life, right? But you learn them. In the Vedic culture, they'll never do that. What they do is you take the body of adult knowledge, figure out what it is you can memorize and simple concepts, that's given to the youngest kids. Then the technical aspects of it are given to the middle-aged kids. And then the, you know, theoretical and theological aspects are given to the oldest, most qualified. Like that. So they break it up like that. But we're used to a different system. You know, what you do in you know, first grade, you don't do when you're in higher levels. So the tendency is, oh, I did that already. Oh, yeah, oh, that again. You know, it's kind of like, you know, sit down and, oh, we got to chant the prayer. You know, and stuff like that. It's just, you know, it's just, well, you know, we've done that. Okay, let's move on. But the thing is these are our culture. And if you don't do them, then you have to do something. Right? There has to be some system to remember that this prasadam came by Krishna's grace. The Lord's grace, I have this. Like that. And so you either accept our system, or you sit there and say, you know, say your, you know, whatever it is, you know, that the Christians will say about, you know, God give us this. They are daily bread, or you say your barucha, or you say something. Otherwise, you know, it's not proper. But we'll just sit down and just start eating. There's no culture there, right? Even the common Christian or Jew has more culture than that. Because they follow a system. It means there's a regulation, there's a rule that governs your life. And you do that. It's a duty. I have to recognize God. So the whole idea is you recognize God at all these points. When I wake up, I recognize, yes, I'm a servant of Krishna, and I chant Krishna's name. Then, I'm servant of Krishna, then, but how? As a servant of my spiritual master, I offer my obeisance to my spiritual master. Then I clean the body. The body belongs to Krishna. How Krishna likes it. He likes us to clean our teeth. You know, he likes us to take our bath and do all these different things. Then we decorate the body according to Krishna's culture. Like that. So this is the way Krishna. So this is something anybody new can learn. So that is the principle. Those are given first. And then as we go, we come to the point of being able to study and understand Bhagavatam. This is, it says, for the mature, experienced. It means they already know how. They know how to put on the tilak. They do put it on. They can taste Bhagavatam. Those that know how to put it on and don't put it on, they won't taste Bhagavatam. That's all. Because there's no culture. So the Bhagavatam is showing you how to take Krishna's culture. Now you're putting the tilak on how to do it and remembering Krishna. That's what the Bhagavatam shows you. So first you have to be cultured. Then you can get the full benefit from it. Otherwise, you won't get. So we have to value the culture. Then we get the result. Otherwise, we won't get. Okay, so, Jai, we'll end here because it's 11 o'clock. So, thank you all very much. Jai, Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai.